Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Welcome to Burning Daylight, the only podcast for the working cowboy.
Well, out of there, daylight burners. Hope you had a good weekend. It was, what's it called? Daylight savings time again. Did it begin? Did it end? I don't know. We fell backwards. Why did we do it? Nobody can give you a really good answer. Even the people that give you like a pretty decent, well thought out answer, the answer doesn't make that much sense anyways. Anyway, it happened and I'm not happy about it. But I like this one better than the spring one. And well, I don't have much of a say in it one way or the other. So what are you going to do, bitch? That's what you're going to do. Welcome back. I changed up my title again, and I don't know if it's I don't know if this one's going to stick, but I kind of like it. I just toned down. Instead of the fucking farm report, it's the friggin' farm report. And I don't know. Nobody's told me whether it was good or bad yet, so until I hear otherwise, or I change my mind, that's what I'm going with, the friggin' farm report. Sorry, thought I had my nose properly evacuated of all foreign substances and mucus before we started recording, but I was wrong, as you can tell. Anyways, starting it off, we got a speaker. We don't have any sort of spending bill or plan to prevent the government from shutting down. Some would say that's a bad thing. I'm not saying it's not bad. I'm not saying it's the worst thing on earth either. But it doesn't appear that we're any closer to that. I know that there was, I saw an article here earlier that said there was like 60 GOP members of Congress signed a letter urging the new speaker to focus on the farm bill. But let's face it, that's not going to happen until this, you know, government shutdown deal is averted. The new speaker. We'll talk. Hopefully, the boys can make it this week for Fence Post Politics, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Then with this new speaker guy. But in the meantime, I've noticed that. So how did I put that? Environmental groups sound a lot like RCAF USA. And I wanted to put this up on the screen. So if you're an audio listener, don't worry, I'll be reading along from an article. This is from The Progressive magazine. It's written by Rebecca Wolf, who is, she is a senior food policy analyst for the national advocacy group Food and Water Watch. Food and Water Watch is, we click on their page. It is with more than 2 million supporters. Food and Water Watch fights for food, safe food, clean water, and a livable climate for all of us. We protect people from the corporations and other destructive economic interests that put profit ahead of everything else. We believe in a healthy and livable planet. We all deserve a healthy and livable planet. I don't know, the way we treat the Earth, I don't know if we deserve that at all. Human dignity. We all deserve human dignity and to have our basic needs met. By who? Who is to meet our basic needs? And why do we deserve them? That's a good question. I'm not going to ponder on that any further. Justice for all. We all deserve justice. People of all races, religions, genders, and sexual orientations deserve fair treatment and equitable opportunities and outcomes. Classic progressive lefty social justice woke speech. Economic fairness. We all deserve economic fairness. Let's support the many, not the few. Pretty classic Marxist tropes there. Real democracy. We all deserve real democracy. Our votes and voices can't be defeated by corporate money. All right, I don't know if we deserve real democracy, because like I said, we've kind of outsourced our caring about how the world runs to a group of senile and crazy perverts, a lot of them. Yeah, and if they're not senile or a pervert, then they're probably crazy. Or they're crooked. If nothing else, like the big common theme of them is they're crooked. Just about every single one of them. Thomas Massey's cool. Rand Paul's cool. Mike Lee's okay. That's about it. Anyway, so this Rebecca Wolf from Food and Water Watch, she says the United States food system is facing a crisis eerily similar to what we experienced almost 100 years ago. A corporate-dominated marketplace strangled by an elite few that holds farmers and consumers hostage to greed. Does that sound familiar to some advocacy groups and trade associations on the cattle side? It should. And it's a statement that I tend to agree pretty heavily with. So a crisis eerily similar to what we experienced 100 years ago, a corporate-dominated marketplace. Yep. Strangled by an elite few. Yep. Holds farmers and consumers hostage to greed. Yes. They conveniently left out the government aspect of that. Because when they're talking about the corporate dominated marketplace, that's all put in place or made easier to put in place by regulations that are passed by corporate crony members of Congress and staffers it's all a good old boys club. Crooked as the day is long. She goes in talking about the first farm bill, which was brought forth during the New Deal, Great Depression era. I believe it was the first, I should have done the research on this, but I believe that the first farm bill was the first time that cattle were classified as a commodity product, as opposed to a non-commodity product, I suppose. I don't know what the actual term would be on that. She says a bad policy. Oh, here we go. Big agriculture has turned the food system into a cash cow for the powerful few by undermining small farmers and encouraging operators to get big or get out. So big agriculture, she says, but that was a U.S. Department of Agriculture secretary. So that Secretary of Agriculture is the one who said that, to get big or get out. That was during the 60s, 70s, during the Great Society stuff under LBJ, I believe. Farm Bill began as a seminal New Deal social safety net legislation, has become corporate welfare, plain and simple. And like all other forms of welfare, it has the poor, in this case, the small farmers, all up on that tit. Just try to get a count of every federal program there that you can think of for farming, in particular, like crop farming. Not so much on the livestock end of things, but row crops, grain crops, produce, all that stuff. There is so many different programs. The dairy industry is another one, with price floors and all sorts of weird shit. Corn's another one with the ethanol mandate. And and because of that, you have your average American farmer kind of just at the whims of the federal government. And they've a lot of times maybe they're producing crops that they shouldn't be, but that's what the incentive is there. The incentive is to grow corn, soybeans, whatever the case may be, rice or sugar, depending on the part of the world, the country that you live in. And how much of it they can put in the school lunch program then there'll be incentives for you to grow it and different crop insurance and all the tricks that they use to keep you on your tit. So she says, thankfully, there is a substantial political pushback. In a rare case of bipartisanship, support for reining in big ag's power has united the Biden administration and Congress members from both sides of the aisle. And then she kind of loses me after that. A fair farm bill gives sustainable, humane farmers a fair shot by halting new and expanding factory farms. Factory farms are the instrument of big ag's control. A single operation can displace dozens of smaller farms. She doesn't define what a factory farm is. There are at least 1,157 more large factory farms today than when the last farm bill was passed 5 years ago. This is likely an underestimate. In Iowa, home to more than double the number of large factory farms of the next highest state, nearly 90% of the state's hog farms shuttered in the 35 years prior to the 2018 farm bill due to being unable to compete. And so this kind of gets into the crux of what we're dealing with in the cattle markets, but the poultry and the hog markets, they've dealt with it for quite a bit longer, and they're essentially vertically integrated throughout that entire industry. Not a whole lot of chickens or hogs produced by small operators. Most of them are these big confinement operations. Feedlots, I don't know what the percentage of beef that's produced here in the U.S. that goes through a feedlot, but it's a substantial amount. I would I would bet to say 2/3 or better, if not more in the like the 80% range. I don't know. Another something I probably should have looked up. However, that doesn't mean necessarily that some of these confinement facilities are necessarily bad. I think a feedlot makes a lot of sense for a lot of different reasons. I have a hard time with the big hog farms and in particular the big chicken operations. That one, it just seems. I'm not big on those. But that being said, I stick with cattle because that's what I know, and I know that the feedlot, the advent of the feedlot, and the flaking of corn, and all this different research that's gone into nutrition and whatnot in on the cattle end of things has really streamlined the process of getting beef out to the world, and the United States in particular. What used to take us forever it was like 4 or 5 years to get a steer to slaughter weight. And now we're doing it in hopefully less than 18 months. That's the kind of the target goal for most of the stuff, because that's the cutoff for when it can be exported to, say, Japan and the EU and other countries. That used to, you'd throw Russia in there. I don't think we're doing a whole lot of trading beef with them anymore. I don't know for sure on that, but once again, something I could have looked up, but it was something I thought of on the fly, so I didn't. A fair farm bill cuts the flow of taxpayer dollars towards big ag lobbying. I'm good with that. Check off programs wherein farmers pay into a fund designed to market their agricultural products. Have funneled billions into bolstering the biggest players. A majority of the roughly $4 billion paid into the dairy checkoff program from 2005 to 2018 promoted export policies that benefited enormous producers but sent milk prices plummeting in volatile international markets. Since 2000, the average dairy farm has managed to turn a profit just twice. Huh. Even as heavily subsidized, I don't get how that could be the case, because there have been so many dairies pop up since 2000. So I don't know about all that. She says a fair farm bill ensures federal programs support small and medium sized farms. I don't support the federal programs. But since we have them, yes, they should support small and medium-sized farms as opposed to the giant corporate outfits. Big Ag has hijacked programs like the Environmental Quality Incentives Programs that pay farmers for climate-friendly practices. The grants from the program include a misguided requirement that 50% of projects fund livestock operations, diverting taxpayer money towards dirty boondoggles like factory farm biogas. We'll get into that here in a minute. The biggest players win while tens of thousands of smaller farmers are sent packing, instigating funding caps, and removing the livestock requirement can help. She says the first farm bill was crafted to respond to a crisis of corporate consolidation and influence. Today's lawmakers must heed the same call. It's time to pass a fair farm bill for all. So to get into the little bit of my opinion side of this thing, the farm bill is too big. Just like most of the shit that gets passed through Congress anymore, it says one thing, but in reality, it's just this festering, seething witch's cauldron full of just shit that they stick in there. So you have the food stamp program, you have the crop insurance program, you have the school lunch program, you have all the import export stuff. You have the USDA inspectors from the, you know, the produce side of things to the livestock and meat inspection side of things. All of that, and then you have all the, like, the Farm Service Agency, the CRP programs, all these different crop programs, all these different fencing programs and shit. Most of those come from the Farm Bill, and it's this just massive boondoggle every 5 years, and it gets bigger every year because to get a bipartisan consensus on it, you have the welfare programs for that, you know, heavily impact the inner cities, like the food stamps and the school lunch program rolled into it. And so then you have competing interests from the farmers and the ranchers and stuff, that their views and what they need doesn't match up to the urban side of things. But what's the solution? Throw more money to both sides. That way we can call it bipartisan and we say, hey, we got along. And as we can see, a lot of this shit backfires. And because they're all corrupt and crooked, the big guys get their fair share, more than their fair share, well ahead of everybody else. Excuse me for just a second. All right. So this one is from prospect.org. I found it from... And so there's a couple different articles that... They all tied in with this first article. It all stemmed from that one chick, Rebecca Wolf, writing about. And she'd wrote several articles about a fair farm bill or whatever. So this is Big Ag opens another vein of public funding. Money from the Climate Smart Commodities Program, designed to reduce agricultural emissions, is going disproportionately to multinationals. The COP27 Climate Summit this past year in Egypt, at the Climate Summit, Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, he was Secretary of Ag under Obama as well, addressed his role in President Biden's plan to cut U.S. greenhouse emissions in half by 2030. While urging for international cooperation, Vilsack lauded the department's unprecedented green investments to reduce agriculture's substantial carbon footprint. He singled out a signature new program initiated under his tenure, the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities. Launched in 2022, the program was set up to provide grants and other funding for sustainable farming practices that keep carbon in the soil, prevent deforestation, and other measures. The price tag, just over $3 billion, was unusually high for a pilot program, that's in quotes, surpassing the annual budgets of other long-standing conservation programs that, at least theoretically, were supposed to support many of the same farming practices. Our goal is to make sure small and underserved producers reap the benefits of these market opportunities, Vilsack said at COP27. But nearly a year later, top grants have instead been awarded to large corporate interests, including Tyson, JBS, Cargill, and other organizations underwritten by Big Ag. The program is under renewed scrutiny from watchdog groups, which claim the department has provided limited public information about the selection process for applications, the contracts being negotiated with grant recipients, and the criteria for what exactly constitutes climate smart. And so here's our friend. We don't need USDA facilitating a pay-to-pollute carbon scheme that only goes to benefit big operations, said Rebecca Wolf, Senior Policy Director at Food and Water Watch. In the absence of transparency, outside groups have come to view the program as greenwashing, as a greenwashing operation to market climate smart products without actually cutting emissions. They also allege that the program is a way to use public funds to launch private carbon trading markets, a kind of cap and trade system without the cap, except without the cap or evidence that offsets alone can substantially reduce emissions. An example of how USDA, according to its critics, has lagged behind its fellow agencies in meeting the climate challenge, instead falling back on unambitious policy ideas. Vilsack's testimony at a recent House Appropriations Committee hearing offered a window into the Climate Smart program's origins. He explained that USDA set up the funds at the request of over 80 industry groups and lobbyists, including the Farm Bureau. The department then issued funds from the Commodity Credit Corporation, a New Deal era entity that acts like a savings account. Since its inception, the Climate Smart program was pitched with lofty goals. The program's webpage claimed the funds will sequester 60 million metric tons of carbon dioxide while helping disadvantaged farmers and creating new market opportunities. Okay, I'm gonna pull this off the screen for a minute. And I'm gonna stray outside my area of expertise a little bit. Like I said, I typically stick to cows because that's what I know. But if I remember basic biology back in the day, starting from elementary school all the way up through high school, when I didn't do much on the plant side of things. In college, as far as class coursework goes, I did work at a greenhouse and in the school farm for a year and a half, maybe something like that. And then I've been around farming quite a bit, so I know a little bit. But going back to the biology part of it, biology is all living things, and plants are living material, and they all need to eat. And a plant, rather than eating other plants or bugs or meat from another animal, plants, they need water and they need sun. They need some nutrients from the soil and whatnot. But the big things are water and sun, and also CO2. Because during the photosynthesis process, the plant absorbs CO2, goes through the process of photosynthesis, and releases oxygen as a waste product. So you would think CO2 in the air would be a pretty decent thing, because then your plants are going to thrive. So your crops, if they're green plants, they're going to be able to use CO2, regenerate it through the plant itself, and then expel oxygen as a waste product. So I don't know, maybe the CO2 is better in the soil than the plants get at it more readily when it's in the soil. That part I don't know. However, it just seems like if you're trying to get rid of carbon dioxide, seems counterproductive, because plants need carbon dioxide. But anyway, I wouldn't say that's neither here nor there, or I was about to, but it's actually here and now. So all of these, I think all of these articles, except for one here later on, is within like the last month. So they're fairly recent. But then watchdog groups first inquired in the fall of 2022 about how USDA made these sequestration calculations or how they plan to meet these metrics. They were rebuffed. As mandated by the National Environmental Policy Act, USDA had to conduct an environmental assessment of the program before its official rollout in September 2022. However, no environmental groups were able to assess the evaluation because the department, without explanation, cut the public comment period from 30 days to 14, narrowing the window for when documents were available for review. Petitions to open the review were denied. Review period were denied. In protest, 13 groups sent a letter expressing their concern about how the program was being administered. That's classic end run, end around by the federal government. It's delay tactics. Many of these concerns were seemingly validated in the fall of 2022 when USDA announced its first round of funding partners. The list was dominated by agribusiness giants and other corporations, the bulk of which are large meat and dairy processors that drive the highest carbon emissions. Of the $2.8 billion granted to 70 selected projects, meat packers, Tyson Foods, and Cargill, Walmart, PepsiCo, and animal processing firm Archer Daniels Midland were among the top recipients listed on projects totaling over $490 million combined, according to the review of Union of Concerned Scientists. Meatpacking firm JBS, Seed Giant Bayer, and Target also took in major funding hauls from the first round. So, $490 million, you're looking at what, like 20% of the total budget going to those. On a number of these projects, the companies are not the sole grantee, but a major partner, joined by other commodity groups, research institutes, and trade associations. I wonder how much NCBA got via Tyson, Cargill, Walmart, PepsiCo. I don't know about PepsiCo. Do they sell any meat products? Archer Daniels Midland does. JBS, Target. I wonder how much NCBA got. Not all the grant. Not all of the grant projects are going to corporations. The second round of funding, while far smaller at around $300 million, sent more money to groups supporting regional and medium-sized farms in ways that could very well be beneficial. Many of these contracts are still being finalized at USDA. All right, so they got some good stuff, but about a third less going there. So a little over a third, huh? Yeah. But in both rounds, the largest projects are lining the pockets of big ag. For example, Tyson is receiving $61 million per its own project. Climate Smart Commodities website at USDA only offers a few sentences describing how that grant will green the company's beef products, one of the leading causes of greenhouse gas emissions in agriculture. That is not true at all. It's like 2.9% of all agriculture. So, yeah, that is not true. Given the current consolidation in agriculture, the companies producing the most emissions can't be left out of an emission reduction scheme, of course, but climate groups criticize the funding selections for giving public dollars to companies that have repeatedly violated federal environmental laws. Tyson, for example, was listed as the second biggest polluter of U.S. waterways from 2010 to 2014, and recently settled several multi-million-dollar fines in Missouri and Alabama for discharging toxic waste from their processing facilities into nearby water supplies. It would be like giving money to ExxonMobil to greenwash their operations without any strings attached, said Chloe Waterman, senior program manager at Friends of the Earth. As USDA sees it, grants to large farming operations can be more efficient for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We've got to move quickly on climate, and if you want to scale up quickly, part of the advantage to some of these bigger projects is they can spread costs across more landowners and acres. Ag policy advocates are warning the funds may aid companies in promoting their products as climate-friendly merely through their participation in the program without actually reducing emissions. The program's website explicitly says the funds can help companies market products, but it only offers a few sentences describing what specific sustainable practices are being supported. There's a lot of S's there, but it only offers a few sentences describing what specific sustainable practices are being supported by the funding. USDA says more specific details will come later once contracts are finalized with the recipients. For much of the last year, public watchdog groups have tried to request public documents from USDA to clarify the terms of the contracts. A coalition of advocacy groups met with USDA officials and submitted FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests to get insights into the program. So far, little information has been divulged. One FOIA request submitted by the Center for Biological Diversity tried to pull back the curtain on USDA's prior communications with grant recipients during the application process and which members sat on the selection committee. The request came back with over 60 pages, most of which were heavily redacted, including names on email addresses in communication with department. Getting information out of them is like been like getting blood out of a stone. Hannah Connor, the environmental health deputy director and senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity. In the absence of clearly defined terms, the department may not be able to effectively enforce the program and hold companies accountable for greenwashing their products with public funds. All the major meat producers have started selling goods with the climate smart labeling. So that's nice. I wonder how much of that money goes to finance projects overseas, because all those big meat packing companies, they have huge overseas interests. When they talk about multinational, I mean, take JBS for instance. They're kind of the big one. Brazilian owned. And they've got, I mean, I think they're the biggest, between them and Tyson, for the biggest meat companies in the world. And they've got their fingers everywhere. So it makes you wonder how much of this climate smart stuff is used to build, you know, quote unquote climate smart processing facilities in, say, Mexico or China or Indonesia or, you know, somewhere else. I wouldn't be surprised. I don't have any idea. I don't have any evidence, but I would not be surprised if that was the case. All coming from the Farm Bill / what did they call it? The Inflation Reduction Act, which was really kind of like Green New Deal light, which is all funded by taxpayer dollars. So congratulations. There is a chance that your hard-earned money that you paid somewhat willingly to the government because, well, they throw you in jail if you don't pay, so you just go ahead and pay it. But there's a chance, and I would say a pretty decent chance, that your money is being used to help build a kill plant in Xinjiang province or whatever. That might be a real place. Probably not. If it was, I'm almost positive I nailed the pronunciation. So you're welcome for that. Another tension between USDA and its detractors involved the extent to which data and funding from the program will be used to launch carbon trading markets for agriculture. So this is interesting. The way this works would be that corporations like Microsoft can purchase offset credits from farmers who sequester carbon in the soil. Farmers receive a payment, and companies get to say they're helping reduce emissions to improve ESG scores and other green branding. So that this whole like cap and trade carbon credit thing, it's all a sham. Like they say, just so these big companies that pollute a bunch, that use a lot of emissions, they'll buy these credits from any of you farmers that end up participating in this program, and you'll get a payment because you've put so much CO2 into the ground or whatever, and you've captured all this, and you've done your part well enough, and then some, so much so that Microsoft can say like, hey, I'm gonna go ahead and not do anything on my end except give you some money and say, good job, you're saving the planet, but then I'm gonna take the credit for it, and I'm gonna market all these new editions of Microsoft. We're gonna label them climate smart and friendly. Climate smart friendly. Smart friendly climate. A climate that is smart and friendly. Microsoft. The problem is that it's nearly impossible to verify how much carbon reduction is really taking place. The verification process may also hand over valuable pharma data to large agribusiness or commodity traders, which can then be used to further consolidate the industry, according to a new report from Friends of the Earth and the Open Markets Institute. I'm pretty sure they already got that data as it is. So that bell can't be unrung, I don't think. So I don't know what you do about that. Yeah, I could absolutely see how that'd be the case, but also, what makes it different than it already is? So, it goes on for a little bit longer. Let's see. Yeah, so there's not a whole lot else in there, except that they talk about that cap and trade climate or the carbon market deal. And it says there's growing evidence that these markets are not as effective as advertised. While California and Europe have relied on cap and trade policies for years, they at least incorporate restrictions on carbon emissions. So far, the effort to replicate these markets for agriculture has lacked even that basic stick as a counterweight for the carrots offered by USDA. It raises the question of why taxpayer dollars should be going to set up private markets for companies to trade on, especially when it's not clear these markets actually deliver on their promised public benefits. So, I agree with that statement a lot. Where me and the author of this article would probably diverge is, he's one of the types of guys that say like, it'll be better if we just get the right, if we get our guys in government and they will run it the right way, except they don't. They all bend over for the corporations. They get their sweet vacations. They, buy the wife a new car, some shit like that. And, big corporations keep chugging along like nothing happened. So, but it's funny again, how similar some of these statements, coming from these obviously pretty, I guess I can't say, it's pretty obvious to me. I don't know for sure, where their political affiliations lie, but I think it's a pretty safe bet to say they're pretty left wing, and they're making a lot of the same arguments as a very conservative right wing group such as RKF USA. So, interesting to say the least. And then kind of to follow up, and so this is from Agriculture Dive. Environmental groups blast USDA for extending climate funding to dairy digesters. So these dairy digesters are, I don't know exactly how it works, but they essentially put a cover over your runoff lagoons, which produce methane, because it's all shit water that runs down there. It sits and ferments, and you know, you can see the methane bubbling up from time to time. And what it does is it captures that and somehow refines it to where they're able to use it as fuel, whether, I don't know what exactly they are, but it seems like a pretty good idea. You know, it's those lagoons are put in place. They're you know, they got their liners so they don't leach out into the groundwater. I'm sure they still do some, but you know, they're set up to where they don't do that. And it's probably, and you know, like in our case, where so it doesn't run off into the river, which is probably a good thing. You know, you don't shit where you eat, you don't shit where you drink. And that river's a source, it's a lifeline for a lot of people. So yeah, you keep it as clean as you can. And that means not just dumping a bunch of cow shit in the river continually. So it makes sense to have those lagoons. And then, you know, I think it's fairly well established that like methane escaping into the atmosphere is probably not a great thing. I don't know the science behind it exactly, but that one I can get my head behind. Like, yeah, it seems right. Probably not a great thing. So these digesters, not only do they help solve that problem from the cattle side of things, dairy, feedlot, but they also capture a usable product. Seems like a win-win. But this is where the environmental groups will diverge from RCAF, and because now they're you know, it's these big dairies and feedlots that are big corporate owned outfits that are putting in these digesters, and they don't like that because factory farms or something. And you're just like, man, I don't know if you're bought into this whole climate thing that we've got to take action to stop the earth from, you know, Epsteining us down the road. This seems like a good step because, you know, people are still going to eat beef and drink milk and eat cheese and all that good stuff. So in the meantime, like while you're figuring out how you're going to take us away from this, you know, method of agriculture, you know, people got to eat still. So this seems like a pretty good solution in the meantime, if it works. And it does, from what I've heard, it actually does work, you know, captures methane and they're able to convert it to a usable source. I mean, that, it just seems like it almost seems too good to be true. And I guess, I mean, if this funding that's already been approved and, you know, voted on and all that good shit, so it's already there, and it's meant to, you know, lower emissions, I don't see why the big outfits shouldn't get their shot at it too. If it's all publicly available funding for this, and it's there to address a concern, and it seems like it definitely does that. I don't know. Environmental groups, though, because they think it's gonna lead to even more of these so-called factory farms, and that might be the case. I don't know. But in the meantime, we already have these big dairies and big feedlots, and they're already using these digesters. That seems like a good thing if it's getting rid of the methane from being released into the atmosphere and actually been able to use it for something productive. Seems like an okay thing to me, but apparently not for these tree huggers. But what are you gonna do? I'll tell you what you're not gonna do is please those fuckers. That's for sure. And then kind of to wrap up on this particular, it's kind of the bulk of this show, but it all does kind of play in. Bayer and Danone, I don't know how you say it, Danone, joined over 130 companies to urge decarbonization ahead of COP28. The coalition, which includes companies like Nestle and eBay, represents nearly $1 trillion in annual revenue, is asking policy makers to end reliance on fossil fuels. Coalition representing 131 companies is urging national governments to phase out burning fossil fuels and scale up the production of clean energy ahead of the UN COP28 climate change summit, according to a Monday release. The Fossil to Clean letter was organized by the Climate Focus We Mean Business Coalition, signed by businesses generating nearly $1 trillion in global revenue, including Nestle, Bayer, Danone, IKEA, eBay, Unilever, and Volvo Cars. The letter calls for political leaders to accelerate the clean energy transition by committing to reach 100% decarbonized power systems in advanced economies by 2035. And provide financial support to developing countries so they can reach this goal by 2040. So by 2040, everyone's off of fossil fuels completely. So what is that, 16 years? Essentially, we're coming up on 2024 pretty fast, so we'll call it 16 years. Am I just seeing this wrong where, like, I figure, like, I'm a pretty smart guy, but, like, I shouldn't be deciding energy policy for the United States. I shouldn't be deciding energy policy for the state of Nevada, probably not even for my own county. But there's this big push for electric vehicles, but there's not many places to plug them in. They don't go very far. I like the idea of electric cars in cities, particularly if they're being charged on nuclear energy, which seems like a pretty useful thing if you're worried about emissions. It seems like nuclear is a good place to turn, but then again, maybe it's not. I don't know. But to me, it seems like a pretty decent idea. Talk to my dad, he would totally disagree. And he's got pretty good reason to. But I can see, as your kind of average layman, These electric vehicles are not going to work in rural America because shit is too far apart. And then even if they do find a way to make these pickups, and eventually they probably will, like they'll make a pickup, electric pickup that can go 500 miles or whatever, and charges in, you know, a handful of minutes or whatever. That's probably coming. But doesn't take into effect all of the cobalt and the lithium and shit that's used to make the batteries for that car, that all gets dug up in open pit mines or dug out of the ground by child slaves in Africa. So like, that's not good. You don't, I wouldn't think. I'm okay with mining, for the most part. However, open pit mines are a real eyesore, and seems like overall probably not great for the earth. But yeah, it seems like a little hole punched into the ground to suck up some oil makes a lot more sense than a bunch of child slaves in Africa or open pit mines to make these batteries for electric cars that are really not ready for prime time. Like, there's still a lot of bugs being worked out on these things. And I'm not saying they're not good cars. It seems like those Teslas are pretty freaking cool. However, the whole thing, and this is just one aspect of the economy, and that's just the vehicle sector. But that's like one of the big pushes they're making, and it's just not ready. And we know, and particularly over the years, since the advent of the internal combustion engine, my God, have they got advanced, and the amount of power they can get for a fraction of the fuel, well, pretty big fraction, but still, like, the amount of the fuel economy has increased so tremendously since say like the 40s, 50s, 60s, and you know, when cars first really started to get popular in the United States. Yeah, compared to back then, a gas engine nowadays is like it's not even in the same sport. It's crazy how advanced they are. And then with I never understood why, like, Priuses, all those hybrid vehicles looked so gay. It's like they were purposely trying to get people to not buy them and to make fun of them. When, in all seriousness, it was a really good idea, and Toyota has kind of been, I don't know what exactly, but they've been like screaming at the top of their lungs. They're like, hey, we could do a lot more with hybrids instead of going full electric vehicles until they're ready. You know, he's like, we can make 8 hybrid vehicles with the same amount of lithium and whatnot that it would take to make 1 fully electric vehicle. So why don't we work on that? You're going to be reducing your emissions, using less lithium and less oil, which seems like a good thing. I guess eventually, if everybody's driving hybrids, you know, the lithium consumption is going to go way up, but you're going to be burning a lot less oil because they're hybrids. They get a lot better gas mileage. And like I said, with all these things, as the more advanced they get, like, it took Elon Musk to be like, hey, electric car doesn't have to look fucking stupid. Like, they can look kind of cool. They can actually be cool. Why don't we show people how they actually are cool? And if you talk to some of your mechanic, like your nerdy mechanic friends, they'll tell you, like my cousin Robbie, he was telling me about how it's just instant power to all 4 wheels at the same time. So like, you don't build power like you do with a combustion engine. It's just instant power, but also like once the juice is gone, it's done. And yeah, it's an amazing technological advancement, but I think it has its time and its place, and the time is somewhere in the future, and the place is probably going to be in your major metro centers as opposed to rural America, because as far as I know, they haven't made an electric tractor yet. And if they do, boy, that'll make farming really gay. You have those old fucks in overalls, talking shit about whose GPS driven robot is better. It'll be strange, but you got to think someday, probably sooner than we think, that might actually happen. Anyways, but all these big companies want them to get off of fossil fuels completely by 2040, and that includes the developing world by 2040. But like all the major economies, like what we consider the first world and second world, even they want them off by 2035. And it's, I don't get the end game here. I don't understand it, but. Anyhow, it's interesting. Well, so that wraps up the farm bill, climate spending, all that nonsense. We'll move on to another gay subject, and that's plant-based stuff. This is also from Agriculture Dive. Consumers want the plant back in plant-based, says a report. Companies will use more ingredients like mushrooms, walnuts, tempeh, and legumes in place of complex meat alternatives in 2024, Whole Foods predicts. So, this kind of makes sense to me, and I'll explain. I'll give a little analysis after, but Whole Foods forecasted a trend of more companies putting plant back in plant-based products, the grocer announced earlier this month with their 2024 predictions report. With a focus on protein content, more plant-based products are using ingredients like mushrooms, walnuts, tempeh, legumes, in place of complex meat alternatives. Plant-based milks are also following suit as well, as some brands pump out products with just two ingredients. Plant-based category has faced criticism in recent years, with many consumers growing confused about what classifies a product to be plant-based and whether or not it is healthy. Leaders in the plant-based category like Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods have run with the strategy of creating a product that mimics the real thing. However, their recent sales have shown that the strategy may be losing steam with consumers. Mostly because it tastes like ass. Beyond Meat, for example, saw its revenue plummet by almost a third last quarter, and the company said there was a considerable gap between the strong health credentials of our products and a broader color narrative that is now afoot, and this gap appears to have widened. So they're saying it's still a very healthy product, but nobody believes them. Well, for good reason. The second ingredient listed in El Segundo, California-based company's popular Beyond Beef patty is expeller-pressed canola oil, which contains trans fat and have been linked to health problems. The product also contains pea protein, rice protein, natural flavors, potato starch, and sunflower lecithin. The Impossible Burger starts with soy protein concentrate and has other ingredients like inflammatory sunflower oil and modified food starch. According to the Whole Foods report, an increasing amount of shoppers are looking for recognizable ingredients in the items they buy, which they were trying to turn the hippies into a bunch of fat fucks, and it didn't work, because if there's one thing the hippies are good at is just buying like simple food ingredients. Like they eat pretty clean for the most part, so it's not really a huge shocker that a bunch of processed veggie goo shit didn't go over well with the natural organic hippie types that tend to be the vegetarians and the vegans. Let's see. Actual Veggie is another group. Brands like Actual Veggies and Meaty sell products that align with this trend, according to the report. Because it says an increasing amount of shoppers are, yeah. All right. Actual Veggies Green Burger features ingredients like broccoli, kale, yellow onion, white bean, and oats, while having a relatively high protein content. And Meaty's Carne Asada Steaks uses ingredients like mushroom root, salt, and fruit juice for color. And then there's like almond milk and whatnot. They started taking all the bullshit out of that too. So it's just walnuts or almonds and water. So oddly enough, not milk at all. Not milk at all. Can you imagine if there were tits on an almond? Like, would they be hard? Would you have to have like a beaver, like a baby beaver to suck on an almond nipple? I'm not sure how that works. But also, going right along with that article, this was from, I guess it was within the last month, but from studyfinds.org. Can masculine marketing boost men's interest in vegan food? Is that a Wurzburg, Germany? All the good stuff comes from Germany, don't you know? We've heard it all before. Eating plant-based meals is not only healthier for us, but also beneficial for the planet. Yet the age-old perception associates meat eating with masculinity, making it challenging for some men to embrace veganism or even vegetarianism. So, a new study is asking, do plant-based diets need an image makeover? It's funny, they never take into account that meat just tastes good, and it's also very good for you. Which has nothing to do with the masculinity part of it. It's just like, I like it because it tastes good, and seems to be pretty good for me. Gender stereotypes often label vegan diets as more suitable for women, leaving men out of the picture. The new study probes the potential of marketing to bridge this gap. Well, it's more suitable for women because this whole vegan vegetarian fad being driven by upper middle class suburban moms. So that could possibly be why it's seen as a feminine diet, because it kind of is. Men might be less inclined to consume vegan food due to the need to perform gender, says study lead author Alma Schultz, who performed the research at the University of Wurzburg and is now studying at Stockholm University. However, with vegan food being framed in a masculine way, men might feel less resistance and become more likely to consume it. So they're gonna like start making Navy SEAL movies, but they're all vegan Navy SEALs. And like they keep losing the gunfight because they have, before they shoot somebody, they have to let them know that, hey, we're vegan Navy SEALs and we're brave and strong because of it. And then they shoot them, but because they're too busy explaining that there are in fact vegans, they get shot first because, you know, you can't be vegan without letting everybody know at all times that you are indeed a vegan. The deep-rooted cultural ties link meat consumption with qualities like strength and masculinity. Simultaneously, plant-based meals are often considered less fitting for men. Gender-based view on food choice is changing slowly, with recent surveys noting an increased acceptance of vegetarianism among men. However, researchers say the concern about reinforcing their gender identity through consumer choices makes men's meat consumption still dominant. Here's the thing with like the vegan and vegetarian diet. nobody else eats it. So we, and it's like the same thing with the transgender deal. They're like, okay, you're a dude now. Okay. Well, tomorrow you're going to be a woman though. I don't understand this anymore, and I'm not going to play along. So I'm going to call you what I know you as, and if you get pissed off, fine. It's like trying to, like your kids at some point, you know, like, oh, do you want this or this? And like, I want chocolate chip pancakes. I'm like, I didn't, that wasn't an option. Okay, well now you're eating this because you need to eat and you're not eating a bunch of bullshit. It's like, you know, you just don't invite the vegan to your cookout because you're like, ah, I don't even know what to buy. Like, do I buy the veggie burger or do I like just throw a bunch of mushrooms on the grill for him? I don't know. And you're just like, either way, it's not going to be acceptable because, vegans are a persnickety bunch and they're going to find a way to bitch about it. So you just don't invite them, and then you don't have to worry about it. And then you're like, okay, do you want it medium or medium rare? Doesn't matter, because I'm cooking it medium rare. And it is not masculinity's... No, maybe you just stop being so annoying with your stupid diet and recognize that like you're in the minority. So... if you're not going to eat what somebody else is going to cook for you, bring your own goddamn food or show up after the food's done, I guess. I don't know. Fucking stupid conversation to be having. There was, I got an article here about some child labor stuff in California, but take a guess what industry they were in. You chose poultry. You're a genius. Meatpacking in general, but I don't know. Didn't say what ethnicity the kids were, but probably my guess would be Honduran or Guatemalan. Who knows? Might be some sort of Asian. I don't know. But apparently, they had them on the assembly or on the, you know, they had them working with knives and shit, which, and they were all under the age of 16. So 16, I think, is a fine age for a kid to go out and get a job. I think it's a, you know, say 10, 11, 12 is a fine age for a kid to learn how to handle a knife if he's going to be cutting up meat. 14 is not an appropriate age for a kid to be on the disassembly line with a conveyor belt and a knife. Like, you know, that's a grown-up job. Like, go finish school and then, you know, and then maybe come back to that job if you have to, but anyways, I'm not going to go too much in on the child labor stuff. Well, I'll do some more on that maybe next week. So this one is China signs purchase agreements for U.S. farm goods worth billions of dollars. And of course, Cargill, Bunge, and ADM were among companies involved in 11 deals at a formal signing ceremony, the first between the two countries since 2017. Sounds like this deal was a lot of soybeans, so the Midwest guys will be happy about that. Trade with China, I generally think, is a good thing, as opposed to a potential war. And while I don't like being reliant on China for so much stuff, it's probably a good thing that we do trade a lot of shit, because otherwise we might have already been at war with them. China definitely doesn't want a war with us because they are the biggest importer of agricultural goods and, like, you know, fertilizer and shit, but also just food in general. They import a ton of it. For being such a huge country with a ton of people, they're relatively resource poor as far as that goes. So they import a lot of agricultural products from us. And depending on what your thoughts on China are, I don't know. Overall, I think this is probably a good thing. Ron Paul's got a, I don't know if he came up with the quote, but he's the one that I heard it from. It says, where goods cross borders, armies don't. And yeah, and the fact that they're importing such a huge amount from us, they're going to be screwed if it comes to a war and we just completely shut them off. So yeah, I think it's probably a good thing. Did the average small farmer get fucked over in it? Oh, absolutely. Wouldn't doubt it. Not even for a little bit. But all in all, though, I mean, like I said, trade's good. It better than the alternative, I guess. Last one I want to bring up today. This is a letter that was sent to the leaders of Congress. So this was sent on October 10th. It was signed by the Independent Beef Association of North Dakota, Independent Cattlemen's Association of Texas, Latino Farmers and Ranchers International Incorporated, the Livestock Marketing Association, National Grange, National Farmers Union, National or North Dakota Farmers Union, Rural and Agricultural Council of America, and the U.S. Cattlemen's Association. And it says, Dear Majority Leader Scalise, Minority Leader Jeffries, Majority Leader Schumer, and Minority Leader McConnell, we, the undersigned organizations, write in to express our support for the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act. That is House Resolution 3413. This bipartisan, bicameral, where's that? This bipartisan, bicameral legislation would require the Transportation Secretary to issue a rule requiring vehicles manufactured in or imported into the U.S. have devices that in devices installed that provide access to AM radio. It would also, among other things, ensure that AM stations are conspicuous to the driver in the dash and require motor vehicles that do not include AM radio in the interim period between enactment and prior to the Transportation Secretary issuing the new rule to be clearly labeled as such to consumers. AM radio is an essential communications medium in rural America. Local news, weather, and sports reporters are recognized as respected sources for information that affects the lives of millions of rural residents. Commodity market reports are called into local radio stations every day across the country, and well-known agricultural broadcasters remain a trusted source for valuable market reporting and updates. There are more than 4,470 licensed AM stations. How many more than 4,470 are there? AM stations across the country, with over a third of those stations broadcasting in this type of agricultural programming. More than 40% of the radio listeners are tuning in from their cars or trucks. AM radio is also able to carry a strong signal over significant distances up to 700 miles, even during catastrophic weather events. The Federal Emergency Federal Emergency Management Agency's system relies on AM broadcast to deliver critical public safety information in the event of a public safety or national security emergency. When the power goes out in rural America and cell phone networks are down, households are still able to access that emergency information through their car radio. Whether it be the routine or the unexpected, U.S. farmers and ranchers rely on the information transmitted through AM radio to make decisions that affect their everyday lives. The undersigned organizations urge Congress to prevent rural communities from losing access to their favorite local programming ensuring that AM radio continues to be a free standard feature in all vehicles. This is a dumb proposal. You have a way bigger problem with your rural radio stations going under as opposed to running out of AM radios in vehicles. If you like the AM radio so much, keep your vehicle that has the AM radio, or you can buy aftermarket stuff. That's a thing as well. I've been in those parts of the country where the only thing that comes in is AM radio, and I'm glad it's there. But also, making it mandatory for the auto manufacturers to have AM radio on, you know, in a vehicle is not going to save rural America and AM radio. Like, that's not how it is. I mean, like, I don't even know how radio's still alive anymore. Like, I guess there's people that listen still. There must be, because they're still on the air. But it goes the same way of every other industry. There's like bigger and bigger companies buy up all these local radio stations, and they lump them under, you know, whatever broadcasting company, and then they change their format and their guidelines, and that's a far bigger problem to me when it comes to this issue of AM radio than it is making it mandatory to put it in the car. And also, you're asking them to make a rule. So that seems dumb. Of all the things that we have to worry about, all these organizations here, the Independent Beef Associations, the U.S. Cattlemen, National Grange, Farmers Unions. I don't, like, why are you even wasting your time on this? I don't understand it. Seems really, really like a waste of time. But what do I know? I guess they gotta justify their job some way or another. But that's all I got this week. If you got any stories that you think I should cover on this, send them to me, matt@vernon-daylight.com, or you can send me a message on Instagram. It's probably the best way. That's where I interact the most. So anyways, if you'd like to hear all the episodes ad-free, come out early, head over to patreon.com/burnindaylight, sign up there. You get bonus content. You get all the content early, and you get it ad-free. So please go check it out. And yeah, this has been the Friggin' Farm Report. Have a good one, and move your ass. We're burning daylight.
Up in the morning, beneath the stars so bright, pull your hat down, make sure your cinch is tight. Horse is kinda snuffy, cold chill up your spine, we'll get your ass moving, son, we're burning daylight. Burning daylight in the the south, hell of a job done right.